You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, June 20th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal... No, wait a second. In the literal... nor in the metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building. Nor are we in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City, but instead... we are in the lovely San Jose Convention Center in San Jose, California. Shrouded? Not shrouded, but basking in the glow of the overhead lights in this convention center. I'm sorry, folks, it's early. I'm in West Coast. We're here for Netroots Nation 2013. The coverage will last... I'll get into the details in a second, but I'm really excited to have with me as my first guest at Netroots Nation, and very sort of many apropos, one could even argue. I'm talking about Marcos Melitzis of the Daily Kos. Hello, Marcos.
Good morning, Sam. And it's...
we both have...
it's morning for me. It's not really morning for you, though.
I was going to say, then why does your voice sound like mine? We both have these sort of deep, right. Sort of new baritone type of qualities to our voice.
I just woke up. You should have woken up 3 hours ago.
No, I did. I did not, actually.
I actually have a new baby at home, right? So this is your opportunity to...
right, this is exactly...
to actually sleep.
This is a huge vacation in many respects for me, even though I'm waking up rather early on the West Coast. So, Marcos, let me try and see if I can get my thoughts together, because in many respects, I'm still drunk from last night. And that's part of what's happening here. All right, now, in the past, when we have talked multiple times in the past, usually we talk about Netroots. It's the first day, the first hour. I don't want to talk about Netroots. Tough to take stock of it at this point. I think by now, my listeners are aware of what Netroots Nation is. And so I don't think we need to go into that. So I want to talk sort of politics and with you and just get a sense of where do you think we are? It's a very weird time, I find, in terms of our politics, because, I mean, immigration is moving forward, and I'd actually like to talk to you about that, but in the main, there seems to be this sort of gridlock. There seems to be sort of a fracturing of the two major parties, or at least in some respect. Give me your sense of that.
Yeah, I'm not seeing fracturing on the Democratic side. In fact, I'm seeing the actual opposite. When we began, and it's a little Netroots history, I guess we're going to inevitably go there, but when we came on the scene in 2002, the first big wave of Netroots activists, and by Netroots, people who are waging politics online. That's the only... so email, blogging, Facebook, whatever. If you're talking politics online, you're a Netroots person.
Let me just ask you one more question about that. I mean, yeah. Without sort of getting too meta. What differentiates someone who is writing for a Washington Post blog let's say, Greg Sargent,
right,
who started like sort of more in the net roots,
yeah,
or Ezra Klein, at that matter, or Adam Serwer, who's now working for MSNBC.com. What differentiates? I mean,
nothing. I mean, the fact that I've remained independent and they've gone to a established media organization, but really, there's a blurring, and I think it's sort of the general trends, or what I'm seeing in the Democratic Party. There used to be this divide. We were on the outside, just like the bloggers were on the outside. And then you had this establishment that was sort of clinging to the notion that they were the official voice or whatever that it was, whether the media, old media, or whether it was the Democratic Party. Now, the problem we had with the Democratic Party was that they weren't representing what we thought were our interests, that they had lost their purpose. They'd forgotten what they were for and who they were for, which actually, in a lot of ways, is not very different than what we saw with the Tea Party, which believes the same thing. But here's the big difference, is that the Netroots, from the very beginning, we were very data-centric. We were focused on the polling. And the reason we could do that is because even back in 2002, the American people were with Democrats on every single issue, except at the time, gay marriage. That was the only issue where you'd say, okay, we're not with the American mainstream. But on taxes, on guns, on Social Security, go down the list. Every single issue, the American people were with us. And Democrats refused to believe that. They had bought into this notion that this was a center-right country. They had bought into the notion that they had to be more conservative in order to be electable. And so they assisted in this push of the country to the right. And it was obviously for us, people like me and you, it was frustrating on the outside because we knew how to read polling. They apparently didn't know how to read a simple poll. We knew how to read polling, and so our purpose was to push the Democratic Party towards the American mainstream, which is actually the exact opposite of the Tea Party, which is moving the Republican Party away from the American mainstream. But we had that advantage. I mean, that's what we, you know, the Tea Party doesn't have that advantage. I mean, our advantage was that we actually, the American people agreed with us. So that was where we came. So over the last 10 years, 11 years, we've actually made a lot of progress in getting Democrats to realize, oh my God, maybe people do agree with us. You know, in 2006, it was on the Iraq War when we kicked out Joe Lieberman from the party. In 2008, the Democratic Party came around on immigration because it had been very hostile towards immigration reform before 2008. By 2011, Occupy movement really pushed the party towards a more populist orientation. And by 2012, marriage equality, sort of the dam broke on marriage equality. So I'm not saying that all Democrats understand this, but little by little, I think it's starting to sink in.
You know, it's funny. I mean, because I have the, you know, relative to the success of the Tea Party, it seems to me that they are far more successful in many respects than we have been in terms of, and despite the fact that from a polling standpoint, we actually have a broader coalition of support for those issues. All right? I mean, just for example, Social Security. We have a Democratic president who is proposing to cut Social Security through CPI. Things like, you know, the move that we saw, the populist move that we saw that the president took, I don't know that it's broadly shared by the Democratic Party in terms of economics. I mean, you know, Senator Warren, great example of someone who is, I think, you know, sort of the genuine article. She, you know, she's talking about the trade deals at this point. The entire rest of the Senate voted, you know, essentially she was holding up Michael Froman, one of the trade representatives. That's going to become a very big issue, and I don't know where we're going to see the rest of the Democrats on that. And so
it's a long-term process. I'm not saying we declare mission accomplished and declare a victory, but considering where we were 11 years ago, there's been great movement. We have much better representatives in Congress, in the House and the Senate, and we're going to continue in that process. It's going to be a long-term process. There's a lot of entrenched interests, but the fact is that you have, you know, virtually every Democrat except three that are now for marriage equality. I mean, that was unfathomable just a few years ago. On immigration, we have Democrats who have held up immigration in the past who now are really quiet about it and may actually vote for reform instead of actively opposing it. So little by little, people are realizing that maybe the way, and my argument has always been that we win when we are actual Democrats. And not just on the issues, but now, of course, on the demographic changes. I mean, last year was the first year where more white Americans died than were born. And the white population grew by 7%, grew last year.
But it was all immigrants. Contribute to that.
It was all immigrants. So, I mean, this is a crazy thought. Of the 2.4, or stat, for the 2.4 million people, new Americans last year, either born or immigrants, 2.4 million, 93% of them were people of color.
Wow.
And the other 7% were white immigrants. So not even the kind of people that will vote Republican.
See, this is why I see that we have this type of progress when we're talking about social issues, because demographically, there's certain realities that you cannot deny. Now, the Republicans can deny it because the way that their electoral success is structured, right? I mean, their base is literally the size of a congressional district, and each one of them is talking to that base. They're going to, I think, I don't know what's going to happen in 2014 in terms of the Senate, but I think following 2016, I don't see how they could ever control the Senate again.
Right. I mean, there's 10 legitimate Democratic Senate pickups in 2016. 10. And, without trying to find.
And I don't know how they're going to win the presidency in the next 10. Like I said, I believe it's, the Republicans will not have an opportunity until 5 years after Rush Limbaugh has retired from radio, and but they will in their congressional districts. And so I'm not surprised we're seeing more of the Democrats being responsive to the demographic trends that like guys like John Judas and Roy Teixeira talked about like 12 years ago, 13 years ago, I think it was, maybe more.
That was about then, when we came on the scene, so it was about 11, 12 years ago. Yeah.
The question is that on the economic front, what's going to push them? Because that seems to be you're bumping up against far more entrenched forces.
Absolutely, and it's going to be a long term process. But again, demographics. I mean, this is one of my favorite stats, and it's from a Pew study on the attitudes of Americans towards economic issues, and they were asked, "Do you have a favorable view of socialism?" Then the number one group most favorably disposed towards socialism was Latinos. They were more favorable towards socialism than Occupy Wall Street protesters.
Wow.
So you think those guys...
That I had not heard. I had heard that there was a lot of support, particularly on the young people.
Definitely young people. So Occupy Wall Street protesters were about 62% were favorably disposed. For Latinos, it was about 68%.
Wow. What accounts for that? Just because of where they're coming from?
I don't have a theory. Part of it is what you just alluded to, youth. Right. I mean, people really think Latinos are socially conservative, so they have to be anti-gay marriage. And yeah, your little abuelita is going to be anti-gay marriage. But the median age of a native-born Latino is 18. That means half of Latinos in this country aren't yet voting age.
Wow.
Which is just startling. And then, of course, everything that goes into youth, you apply to youth, so they're more favorable towards reproductive rights, towards marriage equality, towards just general tolerance. And I think there's a sense of we're all in this together. And I haven't really flesh this idea out, but this younger generation really is a generation that is interconnected in a way that none has ever been before because of social media, because of Facebook. I mean, people are friends with they got friends in Iran, right? So when you have Republicans fear-mongering against Iranians, right, these guys are like, I don't know why, I know several Iranians, and they're pretty cool, right? They just party, and they're like, they're just like us. So there's a sense of connectedness and togetherness with millennials that really cuts across this Republican ethos of get yours and it's yours and screw everybody else. And so this is what I think long term is going to be problematic for not just Republicans but also those conservative or corporatist Democrats that are just as much a part of the problem as Republicans.
That's encouraging. I mean, I have to say that of all the people over the years that you and I have been having these conversations now for 9 years, I think, going on, that you have always been one of the people who really had a very long, horizon. And, you know, through the years, Sarah's saying, like, you know, this is going to take time.
I mean, just talking, because I want to really stress this time point. Conservative movement really began in 1964 when Barry Goldwater lost, and lost big. And that's when they began organizing and putting money into the sort of the institutions like Heritage Foundation that became the core of the conservative movement. That was 1964. They didn't win the White House until 1980 with Ronald Reagan. And they didn't win Congress until 1994 during the Gingrich Revolution. So this was, for them, you're talking between a 16 and 30-year process to basically take over government. We really began in 2000, really got started in 2002, or we got started in 2002, but really got started in 2005 after John Kerry lost. That's when it really, the impetus was there. Right. And so we've only been doing this for about a decade, right? So the notion that, you know, people want instant results, and I think we were sort of lulled into false sense of accomplishment in 2008 when Barack Obama won and we won big, and that was because of George Bush's incompetence and there's a lot of energy. So, but we hadn't really completely nailed this sort of takeover, and that's still ongoing. So it took them close to, you know, over a generation to really accomplish their goals. We can't expect that in 8 to 10 years we're gonna do the same thing. But I think we're progressing a lot faster. I mean, just look at marriage equality. That alone is showing. And even,
what do you think accounts for that? I mean, for me, what accounts for it is a combination of demographics, but also a lot of money. I mean, that you have gay money essentially carries a lot of weight. I mean, right now I see that there are basically two groups in this country that are capable of moving the needle. And one is on gay issues, because there's a lot of donor money there. And the other is on immigration reform, because the Hispanic
numbers.
Vote.
Yeah, there's numbers, no money, but there's numbers.
There's no money, but there is an electoral strength there, and there is a cohesion in the, you know, that I think most people who are not associated with that community don't necessarily get, in terms of like a political cohesion. You know, like I'm just recalling when the immigration debate was up during during the Bush administration. You know, you've got one radio show that is getting hundreds of thousands of people out on the street, and that is that. And I think like sort of the white press had no awareness of where this was coming from, and so those to me seem to be the two groups that can sort of move the needle in this environment. And I guess, you know, I guess the real issue is whether or not how much of that Hispanic vote pushes for some type of economic populism.
Well, I mean, the rallies and stuff helped on the immigration front, but really, I think the ultimate sort of nail there was the exit polls. I mean, you had the white vote was about 3/4 of the total voter pool. Mitt Romney won the white vote by 20 points, 59-39. Obama only got 39% of the white vote, and yet Romney lost by 5 points. I mean, that's the math is just nuts.
Right.
It's crazy. That's what immigration is about. The gay movement is probably the single most effective mass movement in maybe in history. I mean, the change of pace, and I think a lot of that came with their efforts to get people to come out of the closet.
Right.
Because the more you knew one gay person, the more you realize, well, that guy's not a crazy freak that I need to be afraid of.
Right.
So, and now, let's not discount Occupy. I mean, the language of Occupy has been really, really effective. I mean, in the Republican primaries, they were talking about the 1%, and they were, you know, you had Newt Gingrich attacking Mitt Romney using Occupy language.
Yes.
So when we talk about economic issues, that has become a much bigger part of the debate, and I think Occupy is single-handedly responsible for making that happen. Is getting people to realize that there is a appetite for economic populism.
All right, let's talk a little bit about immigration reform, because I think this has the potential to really, really, more than anything else, really, really hurt the Republicans, because they seem to be. I mean, there's going to be some blood on the floor by the time this is over, because Boehner,
they're damned if they do, and probably damned if they don't.
Yes.
or the other way around. Either way, they're kind of damned. I mean, as a matter of background, I'm an immigrant. I came to this country from El Salvador during the Salvadoran Civil War, so this is an issue dear to me, and it's one I follow very closely. And you have, you know, like we talked about, Republicans. Some Republicans realize we're never going to win another presidential election. And many states, Texas is on its way out. I mean, over 50% of Texas school children are Latino. Less than a quarter are Anglo in Texas. So you have Republicans who realize, okay, we got to do something about it. You have John McCain, Lindsey Graham. Boehner seems to be in that camp, although he's running scared. And then you have those Republicans who are just xenophobic, the xenophobic right, the people who built the Republican Party.
The 200, right. There's 200congressmen.
And remember, this is a party that built its electoral majorities on the politics of racial resentment. I mean, the Southern strategy was specifically built on, look at all the good stuff that your taxes are giving black people. And it's not a stretch to go from black people to
brown
people, It's actually exactly the language that they're using today. Is that they're coming here to take?
Yes, Lou Gohmert was out in front of the Capitol.
They're taking,
sort of like he couldn't remember. Give me, you're tired and you're hungry and you're poor, and he sort of, you know, it's really sort of an uncomfortable moment. Just so insane. But this is all right. And I think there's a sort of a broad awareness that, like, on a national level, the Republicans, anybody who wants to be in national office, anybody who wants to sort of, like, carry a state that may be, you know, not so deep.
And not just Latinos,
red.
Asians are the fastest growing demographic in the country.
And so there's an awareness that the bigger the audience you have to play to, the more you have to recognize what's going on in demographics. But then you have these 197 Republicans who won in a Mitt Romney district, and I don't know the numbers, maybe 200, maybe it's 205.
I think they gerrymandered themselves into crazy land.
And they're not going to go anywhere. Boehner is going to put up maybe a small bill that has to do with border security, right?
Right.
This is going to go to conference with whatever comes out of the Senate, some version of Marco Rubio's bill.
Yeah.
Then it's going to go back to both houses. That's where the fun starts, right? This is where Boehner doesn't know what to do, because he either puts it to a vote, knows that it's only going to pass with Democratic votes, and it's going to incense at least a significant portion.
He's done as a speaker.
Right? If he doesn't do this, then
his party's done.
His party is done, and he's just the speaker who couldn't react, who didn't have the cojones, let's just keep it, to actually help his party.
Yeah, and the difficulty here is that Republicans really are at a disadvantage no matter what they do, because if they kill immigration reform, the immigrant communities, again, Latinos, but also Asians, will know who killed it and will blame Republicans forever, and that's it. They're done. They're done. Demographically, they are done. But here's the thing. If they pass this, it won't be 13 million new Democratic voters, because historically, when you legalize somebody, only about half become citizens, and of those, only about half end up voting. So let's say 2 to 3 million new votes. That's not a lot. That's not enough to really tip anything. What it is that they got families and they got communities, and so it's broader. But if you legalize these people, like I said, Latinos are the most socialistic friendly demographic, right? Republicans aren't going to be able to compete with these people unless they shift on a lot of other issues, on economics, on marriage equality, on just stopping hateful to gay people, on choice. I mean, they're going to have to. It's not a question of, okay, we're going to pass immigration reform, suddenly we can compete. It's not going to happen. So they're damned either way.
Yes.
Right? They're going to have to shift. But
I mean, the problem is because they've been running against these people for 30 years.
But if you at least don't stand in the way of immigration reform, then at least that gets you one step closer to being able to compete. You still got to do a lot of other things.
Well, it's also something that's not dogging you constantly.
Right.
You're not going through these same battles. It's just you want to clear it off the table. It's what Sean Hannity said.
Right.
You know, at the end of the day, he's just like, we just need to get this out of the way so we can talk about something else.
But what's really funny about this whole situation for me is the only Republicans don't want to do this. clearly, even the pro-reform Republicans would rather not have to deal with this. But they are, because they want to get it off the table, like you just said, right? But here's the next problem, is that while they're trying to clear it off the table, you got other Republicans saying, well, we're going to limit benefits. Well, if you're trying to get this off the table, reminding these Latinos that they still hate them every time they're blocked to do something is not taking it off the table. It's just it's a lingering sore. Every Louie Gohmert and Michelle Bachmann and Steve King press conference is adding is sort of reminding Latinos and Asians and all these immigrant communities, look who is against you. When this thing passes, if it passes, and I'm not convinced that it will, but let's say it does pass, the reaction from the right, the ouster of Boehner, which is inevitable, that's going to again remind Latinos that this really is the party. Not only are they the party they hate you, but they're working to kick out every single person in that party that tried to make this happen. So really, they're in a situation where they cannot win no matter what they do. And I would try to feel sorry for them if I actually gave a damn, but they created this monster.
Yes,
they
benefited
from it for generations. They built electoral majorities. They owned the Supreme Court because of it. They had their own. They had those people on the Supreme Court. Because of it. Now the chickens have come home to roost, and this lose-lose situation is completely 100% of their own making. And as a Democrat, as a partisan Democrat, we win no matter what.
Right. And the idea is to push this fight so that this really comes to a head somewhere in September, October of this year. Is that it? And so that starts to sort of launch the 2014 congressional campaigns.
I mean,
is that the theory? I mean,
honestly, if I were a Republican, the theory would be get this thing off the plate as quickly as possible.
Right. I want to get this.
But their own people are trying to drag this thing out. If it was up to the Democrats, I think they'd pass it quickly and move on.
Right.
And I mean, I don't think there's any electoral calculation here of let's strategically time this for the cycle. It's Republicans who are dragging this thing out bizarrely, because if I were them, I would. The base is going to be angry. You want to pass it, and you want to try to do something else. You go after Obama's made-up scandals again, right?
But
we've forgotten all about those. One, because of the real scandal, which is the NSA stuff, and then two, because this immigration thing is suddenly, shiny
object.
Of course,
the Republicans can't sort of make any hay out of the NSA stuff, because that's they are actually sort of like feeling like we're going to look weak on national security type of thing.
And so, it's funny because I mean the irony of it all, as a electoral issue, it's the perfect scandal for the administration for Democrats, because one, the American people actually don't care. The polling has been very clear that they don't care. So it doesn't hurt Democrats electorally, but the media cares because it's a real scandal.
Yes.
And the media is focusing on that instead of all the crazy nonsense scandals of the IRS and Benghazi and...
Which have basically disintegrated.
Yeah.
I mean, the IRS one has disintegrated.
Right.
Darrell Issa did his best. He had been looking forward for this for 4 years?
Right.
And it just, he couldn't.
So it's amazing how quickly they were pushed out by actual real news for once.
Yes.
This doesn't usually happen.
Yeah, it's sort of fascinating. I was on Ari Ravenhoff's show last night, and we were talking about how the changes in the media have really impacted the capacity for us, like a Benghazi or a IRS scandal to have legs. It doesn't have that ability in the same way that it did in the past.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. But Marcos, thank you so much for taking time with me, and it's always been a pleasure to
absolute
sit down
pleasure
and
always
you.
Has been
Hopefully we will talk to you soon. Go take a nap. I'm looking at that couch I can see right down there.
Alright, thanks so much.
Alright folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to David Dayan and to Digby. We'll be back after this. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report, continuing with our live coverage here at Netroots Nation. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program David Dayan, who was on as in a pre-record yesterday. So this it's not like you're on really. It's not really on.
It's
today.
A daily show that I do with Sam.
That's right. Exactly. Yes. And it is an extreme pleasure. Not to say that David is not an extreme pleasure, but David's a pleasure. But it is an extreme pleasure for me to welcome to the program the great Digby from the Uber blog, Hubba Baloo.
This is a reunion of sorts,
yes,
actually.
It used to be on my Uber blog as well, and it was an Uber blog at the time.
I've just broken the radio station here. Hold on for a second. Scott, will you help me here with the... and I just need people in New York to let me just know how we're doing with sound.
Hello, hello. Can you hear me?
That should be pretty good, I think.
Get up on that mic.
I'll get on it.
Yeah. And so we're here. It's Netroots Nation 2013. I know that all three of us have been to almost all of these, right? And
I've been to all of them.
Let's do a little bit of meta first.
Okay.
Okay.
Now, I know, Digby, you just got here like 15 minutes
ago.
But what is, without sort of having experienced it so far, what is the relevance of this now, and has the relevance changed over the past?
Well, I think it's definitely changed. I think when it started off, it was a it was a gathering of the liberal blogosphere, and that had sort of expanded into progressive institutions and then politicians, and eventually, it sort of became this huge kind of progressive gathering. And, as the blogosphere has, first matured and then sort of started to fade, something else has kind of taken its place, and I'm not sure exactly what that is. I mean, there's obviously a lot of people here. It seems very active and energetic, so, I'll be interested to see what exactly we're doing. There's a lot of conversation about organizing, doing kind of community work, doing some electoral work, all of which is, part of progressive movement building. But it's less online focused, I think, than it was in the very beginning, when it was really a very kind of cozy group of bloggers and readers that got together to meet each other, essentially, and kind of talk out strategy and what we were going to do. And we did a lot. We're still doing things, but it's changing. So.
Yeah, I mean, it does occur to me that there's more sort of like using the internet just as a mechanism to organize people offline in some respects.
It's almost that there are two Netroots Nations. There's the one that has just been sort of the event itself, and I think the first Netroots Nation had maybe 1,000 people that attended. There are 3,500 people that are attending this one. So obviously, at some level, it's a very successful event by broadening the scope of it, by broadening, who participates. That has been very successful for Netroots Nation. For those of us who started sort of at that ground level, who started as online writers and opinionators, it's been a very different kind of progression that has mirrored the progression of the blogosphere in general, which has certainly changed from something that was very very much a community to something that has been a little more fragmented, whether it's because of Twitter or whether it's because of the advertising crisis in progressive media, whatever it is.
Or politics
right?
Itself.
I mean,
we're talking
absolutely
about,
there's
sort of like two different aspects of this. There's the sort of the technological aspects and the implications of technological innovation, and then there's also sort of the political landscape has changed. And back when in 2005 there was
charging the gates kind of quality,
there was a charging the gates quality, but there was also sort of don't Jonathan Alter and I were on the same side of most conversation.
That too.
And
not me.
Well, maybe that was a bad example for you to bring up with Bigby.
But you know what I'm saying? Within the context of even what was then the Netroots, there has been sort of, people have sort of followed paths that seem to have been, you know, some people have grown apart in terms of where they are politically, and the political perspective has changed. And so that's also sort of represented here in some way in terms of lack of cohesion.
Well, I'll be interested to see how it is represented. I don't know what that is, because I mean, there's the straight up sort of political, you know, division between people who sort of identified as progressives first and Democrats second, and others who are the other way, and then there are others who are loyal to the president just on a, because of their own personal commitment to him and his agenda. And we've been playing this out for years now. I mean, this started back in the 2008 campaign and continues to sort of morph into new and different divisions, most recently over the NSA revelations.
Right.
So, you know, there's always that tension, I think, in the liberal coalition, and certainly within the Democratic Party. I don't think it's, I think it's healthy. I think it's really essential for us to have those conversations. I mean, when we were all on one side, although, you know, Jonathan Alter did, just for the record, endorse torture within days after 9/11. So, you know, never one of my favorite people.
Right.
And even today, he's, you know, very rah-rahing all the, you know, the NSA secrecy. So, you know,
I haven't caught up on
you. You really couldn't have picked a worse example for
me. I mean, he's one of my bête noirs, you know, from way back. But, you know, we were in opposition to a crazed right-wing regime under Dick Cheney. Even Jonathan Alter and I, you know, were on the same common ground, and ever since that sort of, you know, common raison d'etre. I don't know why I'm speaking French this morning, but mm-hmm. for some reason I am.
Not the problem.
Yeah. Okay.
My audience is bilingual French.
Yeah, that's about it for me. I've done it. I've done my whole vocabulary now. But anyway, you know, once that broke apart in the 2008 campaign, where many divisions, you know, of all kinds sort of erupted, I think that what we thought we'd built as a movement was different than what we had built. And we have been in the process ever since then of trying to figure out how to be, a progressive influence on the Democratic Party. And so, I think we're still in that process. You know, Rome wasn't built in a day. Neither was the conservative movement. I mean, it took them a few years to get it together, too. So,
true.
You know, I am not pessimistic about this. I think it's actually, it's actually something very healthy, and I think it can be successful. We just kind of have to keep working at it. And events like this can be helpful just in having conversations among people who might not ever meet otherwise.
Right, and getting an assessment. I mean, in some respects, I still sort of feel like there's just still full-on assessment of, and some measure of sort of trying to figure out exactly that coalition that we thought that we had, that movement that we thought we had, is something... is not that thing, and
right.
then this is the question is, what is it?
I do think there's almost a parallel track, because as that conversation has played out and those divisions have sprouted up, there's also been this fractionalization technologically and from, lack of a better word, from the advertising standpoint of progressive media, where, a lot of it has drifted to these very large organizations, Huffington Post and Talking Points Memo, those kinds of things. It's more difficult to get in a national conversation now if you're not, you know, posting cat pictures or whatever BuzzFeed does or whatever. So, and Twitter sort of turned everyone into their own blog at a very micro level. So all of those things have kind of roiled the blogosphere from a technological standpoint at the same time as there has been this division ideologically. So I think that has been a fairly toxic combination, I think, for the progressive movement as it grew up online generally. And so both of those things are sort of playing out at the same time. And, you know, it makes it hard. It would be great if the only problem was ideological. If that was the only thing that was going on, that would be a great thing to have those conversations. The problem is that you're, at the same time, everyone's being squeezed out of the conversation.
Well,
so,
let's put it this way. Yeah. The people who are generally ideologically opposed to the more progressive side are also the people with the money. So, you know, that gives them an advantage in this new technological world. And we're seeing this play out just in terms of blogs and other independent progressive media, which is suffering greatly from this shift in advertising dollars to firms that are placing Google ads, which are targeting certain blogs. And we all have, you know, Google ads on our blogs through some mechanism. But instead of going directly and supporting this infrastructure that we had built online, they're going through this other middleman, which is taking huge sums of money from off the top, and then Google takes money off the top. So our advertising is drying up, and it isn't just blogs. It's happening to independent
media
all over the place.
Yeah, I mean, and part of this we had talked about when you decided to exit the blogging world, David.
Yeah.
But it is fascinating, you know, sort of... It sounds very, I don't know what the word is. I hope it's not boring. But, I mean, the implications of just that small change in the way that these groups are advertising has so much impact because people entered into this, into the blogs, doing the blogs sort of as a hobby or as a hobby's not the right word, but as an outlet.
Yeah.
For frustration. And when it began to catch on, they became more compelled to do it. And then at one point you find yourself like, okay, I'm supposed to be at my job.
Right.
And so...
Some of us were at our job.
Right. And then, but then it became a mechanism where they could remain independent and at least justify from an economic standpoint dedicating part of their day to doing this.
Yeah. Right.
And then the sort of the legs were pulled out from under them, and so it has incredible impact on maintaining the independence of certain voices. A lot of voices have already gone to whatever.
I mean, that's the other part of it, is that a lot of that those voices got swallowed up by these larger sites. You know, magazines finally figured out, oh, if we have a daily web presence, we're going to actually do better than if we just come out once a week with the stories that you can buy off the rack anyway. So. Those things actually also contributed to this harm, and also the technology, Twitter and Facebook, you know, the ability for anyone to have a platform that was much bigger than just a blog platform where you had to go to it. You can go, instead of going to a blog and hearing one person's perspective, you can go to Twitter and hear 100,000 people's perspective. So there are just a lot of reasons why it's just a tougher sell. Obviously, the legacy that, you know, obviously there's an institutional buildup with sites like Digby and sites like Atrios and things like that and Daily Kos. But it's just harder to get in a conversation relative to, you know, a few years earlier. And it was certainly, I felt, and we talked about this, that I had sort of plateaued. And I did the things that I wanted to do in that space, and I wanted to sort of go deeper and do longer form work, and there was just no way I was going to be able to do that when, you know, what has always been the problem of the blogosphere is that you have to publish or perish. You have to feed the beast every
it's
day,
time
many times a day.
Yeah.
And you just can't do two things at once like that.
All right, so let's move from the meta then get into the...
Because no one else cares. But
we're David and I and you are the only ones who care about
I have to say, that's basically the subtitle of my show.
Yeah, that's the target audience.
No one cares about me.
You will indulge me, I think should be the... So let's talk about the NSA revelations. It has been, I don't want to take this into a meta conversation either, but it has been fascinating how it's sort of dominated the media for almost 2 weeks now. And that, I think, can be explained by a lot of things, but... Digby, just give me your take on this.
Well, my take, I'm shocked, appalled, repelled, revolted. I mean, the story is, it's an amazing story, and it is one that I think there's, the reason that it has shaken the media and certainly been, I mean, I'm having conversations with total civilians about this, people who don't normally follow politics. And it is sharply divided, again, you know, polarized, and not along the usual lines, which is one of the things that makes it so interesting. People have a gut feeling about this, based upon a number of things. I mean, I think some of it's just, you know, the polls sort of show that it's a, you know, if your guy's in power, then, right, you know, you're much, you know, you trust them, and so you're much more inclined to give it a pass, and, you know, and vice versa. There's that. But there's also just sort of, you know, there's institutional journalism versus, you know, kind of upstart muckraking journalism. There are hardcore civil libertarians and others who are, you know, I think Chris Hayes sort of created a kind of a frame for this that I found rather interesting called the insurrectionist versus the right institutionalist. He's basing this on his book, Twilight of the Elites, in which he posits that all these institutions, all of them, church, military, government, business, Wall Street, everything that sort of forms our, the institutions of our society, have been failing over the last decade.
Right.
And as a result, certainly in this instance, as a result, certain people have become what he calls insurrectionists. They've been radicalized by this failure and are starting to see things in much more radical terms. Whereas the, you know, the institutionalists still
questioning every institution, questioning almost the concept of institution.
Correct.
Right.
And looking at this in a way that, you know, that they are no longer just sort of have a reflexive trust in institutions, even the ones that they formerly, you know, bought into 100% and would never would have questioned. I certainly get that. I mean, I wrote about this and I said, you know, I'm a Watergate kid, so trust in institutions was very, very low during that period, no doubt about it. But, and I grew up probably being fairly anti-authoritarian, anti-authority as a, you know, and authoritarian as a result.
I'm shocked.
But for a lot of people who grew up in the Reagan years and who, you know, lived through a different time, I think that it's just a given, and I get it. You know, you go, hey, you know, we built this. This is our government. It's democracy. This is what we do. And yet, over the course of the last few years, there's been a, you know, one institute, I mean, the Catholic Church, Wall Street, you know, I mean, it just goes on and on. I mean, there are just, and everywhere you look, there's been this tremendous failure and basic betrayal of trust. So when this kind of thing comes up, what you see these divisions sort of showing among the people and how we're going to react to that is very much in reaction, I think, to these revelations. To me, it's clear. You know, I do not believe the government has the right to be doing this, period, without probable cause. That is just, that's so fundamental to me. It's Bill of Rights all the way. I am not even remotely flexible on that. Having said that, the worst part of all of this is the secrecy going from top to bottom and the catch-22s yes that government is building into this to make it impossible to penetrate that secrecy. That is step one. Step two is we're building a gigantic surveillance state that is unaccountable. We don't know what it is. We don't know where it is. We're empowering hundreds of thousands of people to have the ability to, in some respect or another, have access to information that nobody else does. It's very, very dangerous. I am, you know, tremendously concerned and really grateful to see this come out. You know, it seems to come up every few years. This one seems pretty serious. And
right,
I am, you know, grateful that we're able to talk about this and maybe, you know, radicalize a few more people and get a little bit more, you know, at least, at the very least, acknowledgement or some kind of recognition that this is something that we need to pay attention to. To be honest, I'm not terribly optimistic because civil liberties is one of those things that falls about, you know, at the very bottom of the list of priorities.
Right.
And it's not like people don't have other things to worry about right,
right
now. But I'm hopeful that at the very least there will be some kind of consciousness about this and maybe scare a few bureaucrats and congresspeople into maybe doing at least a little something.
Well, certainly
about
the president's had to deal with it a lot more than I think he ever would have anticipated.
Oh, no, he always wanted the debate.
He welcomed the debate.
He welcomed the debate.
He welcomed the debate.
The debate about his secret program.
Right.
He, you know, he welcomed
as you were talking about, like, Hayes. You know, Hayes is in his early 30s. And so there is that that notion of radicalization after the past 10 years, there is something that's like sort of, I don't know, funny about it, just sort of insofar as like this may be just sort of recycled through the ages, right? This sort of this notion, but it's certainly always the last 10 years that has done it for that, for any person.
Bad 10 years, you have to
without doubt.
And I've seen uniquely
like
so
a series of these things, like even like I think I sort of feel like I read Kevin Drum at one point saying like it was what I saw what happened with the banks that radicalized me. I'm like, wait, he's pushing very far.
Yeah.
He went
there
from center to 49%
slightly left. Kevin's my age. No excuse there.
Right, exactly. But so give me your take on this, David.
Well, it's not something I've written a whole lot about, but I've certainly followed the debate. I think the fact that it's coming from someone like Glenn Greenwald, who seems to uniquely have this ability to anger media figures, mainly because he doesn't pay attention to their dictates, and it's brought up a lot of things about objective versus subjective journalism that have been really interesting, so. I think the fact that it came from him, people had a knee-jerk reaction, the media, at least, the people who are shaping this debate, had a knee-jerk reaction that was negative.
Professional jealousy is an ugly thing.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, it's
very
funny
ugly.
Because we are all privy, you know, we are all on email lists, and we see sort of these conversations, and Glenn Greenwald has always, always gotten under the skin of people who, you know, maybe establishment is a little bit musty of a word in some ways, but they're establishment journalists, and he has always been one of these guys. I mean, this came up, I think, during the when he was being spied upon by private contractors, the H.B. Gary stuff, that they sort of said, like, this is sort of, he's tough nut to crack, because he doesn't really have the same sort of, like, career trajectory.
He didn't intern in some newsroom, and so he doesn't, isn't the same. But
he's also somewhat untouchable. I mean, The Guardian, he still has that arrangement with The Guardian where half his, or I don't know what the percentage is, but he still solicits donations directly.
Yeah, it's funny that he did it right before this happened.
Yeah.
Like, believe me, you're going to want to give money to him.
I noticed that.
So, but the fact is that in the wake of what has come out, the New York Times, Bloomberg actually had an incredible piece, and several other sites have had really deep and wide-ranging pieces about this this secrecy state that has been built. But everyone who, you know, essentially is inclined to defend the president on this goes back like, oh, well, this is Glenn Greenwald's story.
Right.
But it's not. It's actually a story that has gone through many, many iterations, and it's clear that there is a very large architecture out there that we're only beginning to understand and recognize, and we're not near the end. I mean, we're about 2% in to what is actually available in this architecture. But because there's a blame the messenger quality to it, because it was Glenn that sort of first kick-started this debate this time.
And Snowden, too. There's a lot of questions surrounding him.
Absolutely, We have to talk about his girlfriend, and we have to talk about his how much money he makes as a contractor.
What could it mean?
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
I mean, these are sort of like
the most arcane kind of conversation.
Well, that's a common technique, though.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very common for when something is very threatening to sort of the power elite, they will take it personal, and they will look into someone's personal life and intend to discredit them.
I mean, whistleblowers are odd ducks. I mean, you can't do this and be a normal person. I'm sorry. Nobody normal would do this. I don't care.
I could come up with, you know, I also think there's a myriad of possibilities of why we're hearing from this guy. Ranging from, you know, interagency squabbles, none of it to, you know, Manchurian IT guy or something.
Yeah.
But it doesn't, at the end of the day, really matter.
It's
because
irrelevant.
No one's denied anything he said. And so you can leave him aside, burn the tapes of him doing his interview, and the rest of it is irrelevant. It is fascinating to see sort of the way that it is sort of been received, and the way that people have been pushing back on it by being a function of Greenwald or being a function of Snowden. And it's also sort of like a little bit, I think the weird thing about it is the story continues out there, but there doesn't seem to be sort of the significant audience for that story. In some ways, like I don't know how much, you know, from a click standpoint, I don't know that people are clicking on these stories.
I don't have a sense.
My traffic's been down ever since the election, but this story has. My traffic's been up a little bit.
People back.
I am pounding it, and it's
right.
People. I'm sure there are plenty of people who normally read me who are not reading me because of this. If they're on the other side of it, because I have a very strong point of view about it. But there's some liberal. There's no conservatives reading me, but there might. There's some liberal audience out there that cares about this and that is following it. I do think that one of the things that people just really need to keep in mind is that whatever you think of Glenn Greenwald or Edward Snowden, Ron Wyden. And Jeff Merkley and people like that have these guys crazy? Are they horrible people?
Yeah. Those two guys who were basically saying there's something on fire here.
Blinking in Morse code.
And then Loretta Sanchez, I don't know if you saw the video of her. Was really stunning to me.
Yeah.
When she was on C-SPAN and saying, I've just got out of a meeting.
Right.
And she's sitting there just sort of like saying, what can I say about this?
Right.
And she's choosing her words very carefully and basically saying, this is huge.
Right.
Right.
This is huge.
And the larger point there is that what we've learned is oversight doesn't really exist of the intelligence community within a congressional context. And part of the reason why is because, Wyden, Udall aside, congressmen don't want it to exist. They don't want to know
right.
about this thing. I mean, I saw a quote from Charlie Rangeley's where he said, I missed all the briefings. I don't want to know. I don't want to be part of this. I don't want to be attached to this. I don't want to have questions about me, about whether I knew or not this situation. And so there's been this hands-off quality, and it's just another thing that Congress has kind of handed over to the executive branch that allows them to aggrandize their power. And this one, in this case, is much bigger. I mean, obviously, if you allow a secret securities, a national security state to live within the executive branch beyond the reach of oversight, you have a rubber stamp court, and you have a Congress that gets briefed really when they have to be lobbied to further the obligations of the program forward after the sun sets. They aren't really briefings; they're just kind of you should vote for this. It's just kind of a one-sided argument.
Getting back to that sort of circles back to the failure of our major institutions, right? Because when you've got Congress people now who are just saying there's just so little upside for me to know about this.
Right.
Because I'm not going to go out there and speak against it, because that's going to involve me losing money, losing votes, having something that's not going to help me.
Right.
They
just don't want to go up against this large beast that is.
It's really amazing because this is also, you would imagine this would also be something that would really sort of feed the ego of somebody. In other words, I'm going to feel good about myself because I'm going to go out there, I'm going to speak out against this, and that element even seems to have, like,
that's kind of the animating purpose of the Church Committee.
That's what I'm saying.
Frank Church thought he was going to be elected president because he would sit on a committee exposing all these security secrets, right? And there is no context for that now. No one is going to get rich. Ron Wyden is not going to, rise to the highest levels of power in Washington by challenging the surveillance.
Well, it's a different zeitgeist then. It's also important to remember that Frank Church and Pike, who did the other committee, their careers were pretty much destroyed. Right. They were, right. This was not, and I don't know how far back the institutional memory goes, but I suspect it does go back at least that far. It was not a wild success. I mean, what they managed to do some things, and they managed to reveal some secrets, and which had been going on since the late 60s, actually, going all the way back to, prior to Watergate. There was a lot of this.
FBI,
yeah, it was
King.
All of that. It was coming out during a whole long decade of revelations. But the lesson is that this doesn't really pay off. It's not a payoff. You have to be a person who actually is a believer. And how many of those are there in
Congress? It's funny because Russ Feingold, who, were he still in the Senate, I would imagine would be
so.
There.
Oh, absolutely.
And
he's been conveniently shuffled off to Africa, you'll notice, that Kerry gave him an appointment as an envoy to Africa. They put him literally as far away as you can be from this debate.
I don't know if that's timed with this.
I don't think it's timed at all, but it's an interesting coincidence.
But it's also an interesting coincidence that he was probably had the lowest net worth of anybody in the Senate when he was there.
Interesting.
And I can't help but see when guys like David Brooks and Thomas Friedman come out.
Hey, Friedman Forum today. Be there. San Francisco.
Oh.
Get there. You're going, right?
Okay.
You're coming right after?
I'm contemplating that, actually. I really was.
I think it's a coincidence. There's a security zone like a mile around with cab drivers with tasers that are ready to get you.
Just suck on this.
You look vaguely foreign.
There seems to be a nexus between those people who are quick to defend something like this and also those who are comfortably ensconced in a economic system that is rewarding them greatly.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, the other point here is that there's this perverse logic to outsourcing a lot of these things and put them in the hands of contractors because contractors can give donations in a way that, the NSA cannot give money to a candidate,
right.
But Booz Allen Hamilton can give a lots of money to a candidate and get them on their side to basically look the other way on a lot of this stuff.
Well, Eisenhower's famous military-industrial speech,
right.
His first draft was military
congressional-industrial
complex, and they persuaded him for some unknown reason.
Well, you guys are both Hollywood types, right?
Oh, yeah.
You
sure.
Know the bottom line is that if your agent's making money,
yeah.
if your business manager's making money, if your manager's making money, if your publicist is making money, they'll make sure that you're making money.
Yep.
And I think that's the problem with incentivizing something like this is that it's just the money's just flowing and it's just one more reason not to stop the gravy train because there's too many people who are on it at this point.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is one of the things I think it's important to sort of also emphasize on this story is that a lot of people have chosen up sides based on their affection or loyalty to the president. This isn't about Barack Obama. It really isn't. This is a bipartisan building up of a foreign, a national security surveillance state over the course of many, many decades. This is just, in 9/11, it escalated after 9/11. After a sort of a bit of a walk back because of the end of the Cold War, this national security state was having to justify its existence, and 9/11 gave a perfect excuse to build it back up again. But it isn't about him. He's just another president.
He's a vessel, I completely agree with that.
With all the, my anger, to the extent that I have anger towards President Obama, I found that the anger that I had towards him was much more direct when it came to the sort of the banking crisis and what's going on with the Department of Justice and what's going on with mortgage fraud, et cetera, et cetera.
We can get into that if you want.
Yeah, well, I mean, this, I sort of feel like I actually believe that to the extent that he is reacting to this, that he is at the margins trying to chip away at it a little bit.
I don't know about that.
I don't even know that either, but I just don't hold him responsible.
Right.
This is, this
you
is,
have
you know,
to sort of accuse the entire breadth of Washington of something like this.
Yeah, this is a bipartisan thing that, both parties do. I mean, I can't even imagine what it would take. Bernie Sanders, if we could maybe elect him for president. maybe he might do something mild.
No, this is something actually I think where Congress...
Congress
has the greatest power here.
Yeah, I do too. And the press, if they would actually wake up and stop... Yeah, and not to say there aren't great crusading journalists on this, these stories from, you know...
Bart Gellman.
Gellman and James Reason. I mean, you know, there are a lot of them that have been
working with
Dana Priest. Yep. And Glenn Greenwald. I mean, these are people who have been fighting this fight for a long time, and they continue, you know, they fight through their own bureaucracies and their own newspapers to get this stuff, you know, out there. And sometimes they fail, and the government is pursuing them. Poor James Reason, I mean, he's definitely been harassed by the government.
I think Michael Hastings, frankly, also was being harassed significantly. From what I've read.
He was, and I find it very interesting that now he, you know, everyone has so much affection for him, as they should. But at the time, I seem to remember a lot of establishment pushback on
him. And it was very similar to the Greenwald thing. Like, he didn't go through
the
right channels. You know, that stuff was off the record, or you know, you don't go, how dare you go talk about McChrystal in that way?
Yeah. He's a good guy. I remember Laura Logan, you know, absolutely just furious that Hastings said this about her friend McChrystal, you know, and so, you know, now, I mean, obviously, the Hastings, you know, he tragically...
Kind of memorialization
that's why,
common.
I get that, but nonetheless, I know that some people are using him in contrast to Glenn Greenwald, and I'm thinking, hey...
What?
Oh, yeah, and saying, you know, well, Hastings was different because he was a nice guy, and
Glenn isn't a nice guy,
you know, at the time, people didn't think Hastings was really a nice guy, I hate to say it, but people had the same reaction.
Profile.
To him, exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. And if Hastings were here, I'm sure he would say that's bullshit. And that, you know, if you look at the New York Times obituary yesterday, for Michael Hastings, absolutely tries to discredit his big story. Again, his wife had to write an angry letter about it and say, no, you're wrong. But even in death, the establishment media is still refusing to give him his due. So, these kinds of, you know, the press has been very, and this goes back to, you know, all the way to the 50s, the Cold War. I mean, they were, you know, basic CIA agents writing for the New York Times, you know, so this isn't new.
I have a theory about a couple of them right now.
David Ignatius,
people like
that. Oh, my God.
It's a very strange time, and guys, I appreciate you taking the time to talk about it. Now, David, we will talk shortly because I know the mortgage.
The other whistleblower, the bank of America stuff.
You know, maybe we'll even talk about it tomorrow, or at the very least, because I really want to talk about this story.
I'm pretty much stuck here every day, is what he's saying. Now, we'll do a triple. I think your audience is going to rebel against you.
We were in a
movie together.
You know this, right?
I did not know that.
So when I was in college, he had a friend who I knew that was putting a student film together, and his friend flew you out, right? Flew you out, but you were in Boston at the time. You weren't in. This is at the University of Michigan. Okay, but you were living in Boston then.
Yes, that's correct.
So he starred in this student film, and I was also in the film. And this was like 93 or something, and I was in college, and you were just out of college?
I was probably still in high school.
Okay. So
I was well out of
college. 15 years later, it's Netroots Nation, and I find him. There was a skybox that the first year where people were broadcasting from, and I found my way up to the skybox, and I said,
"Just us."
And I said, "Hey, I know you from a student film 15 years ago." And you're like, "You're kidding me!"
and I had been reading. I think at that point you were guest blogging.
Maybe at that point.
And I had been reading, and you were one of my favorites at that time.
That's funny. And you actually flew in to do a student film.
Yeah, isn't that weird?
It was my buddy. I wrote it. I think I he based it on something I had written or something like that. And
he was an overbearing stand-up comic, so it was. I don't know where it came from.
You somehow found that.
For Charlie's second film that they did with the group that John Benjamin came in.
Really?
Myself.
Wow.
Laura Silverman.
Wow.
That's a heck of a it was a an all-star cast for a
we have this weird shared history through comedy where we know a lot of the same people, and it's kind of bizarre.
That is very strange.
Yeah, it is strange.
Very strange.
All right, but
thank you,
Digby, David. Thank you so much.
All right,
I appreciate
thanks
you taking.
For
thank
me.
You. Thanks for having us.
All right, folks. Oh yeah, take a picture, please. Hold on, let's take a picture. here we go.
You're loud.
We're gonna
show
take,
more than the glasses now, sometimes.
Take a little picture. Here we got one coming right here as well.
Oh, okay.
That does not have the sort of scary. People should know that that I am in front of a rather intimidating.
Rather
large. It's kind of like there's a scene in one of the Jaws movies after Roy Scheider decided he didn't want to be in the thing anymore, and they show a there's a picture of Roy Scheider in his wife's house, in Lorraine Gary's house, and it's massive. It's like, well, if Roy Scheider's not going to be in the movie, let's just put a huge picture of him on the wall
in
the movie, in his house, and that kind of reminds me of that.
It was probably giving the finger to Roy Scheider, who'd refused to do it, or they wanted some obscene amount of money, so they decided to just put his picture in there anyway.
I love it.
Put him in the billing, too.
All right.
Let's talk.
Thanks,
guys. All right, folks, we're going to take just a quick break here, and then we will be back continuing coverage. Let's see. I'll be back in just a second. Hold on, bear with me.
Driving on
back, Sam Cedar, the Majority Report. We are live at Netroots Nation's 2013, I guess it is. Joining me now is joining me now is Elijah Zarlin from Credo, the phone company, Credo Action. He is the director of campaign.
Senior campaign manager.
Senior campaign manager.
At Credo.
My audience is very familiar with Credo. At one point, you guys have sponsored the show, and hopefully again in the future. But one of the things that we had talked about with Becky Bond, when she came on the program, was getting pledges for civil disobedience regarding Keystone XL. And I noticed last week, I think it was.
On Monday.
On Monday of this week.
It's been a long week already.
Yeah, I guess so. That you and Becky and about 20 other activists.
That's right.
Got yourselves arrested at a fundraiser?
It was in front of the State Department in Chicago, the State Department office, the federal building in Chicago.
And this is when, President Obama there, or was it, what made you choose that day and why?
The significance of Chicago is, of course, that it's the president's hometown. It's the headquarters of Organizing for Action. And, you know, we are all out there with our Obama hats on, our Obama supporter hats on, saying, we worked for you, we supported you. We want you to make good on your commitments to fight climate change, and that means rejecting Keystone XL. We were in front of the State Department because the State Department is the agency that's currently conducting the environmental review of Keystone. They released their draft in April. It was quite a sham, actually. Two dozen scientists submitted an official comment saying it was without scientific merit in critical areas. Most of it was written by an oil industry allied firm, Energy Resources Management. It's literally in the American petroleum industry, which is a fact that the State Department had redacted from some documents that many of the ERM's employees had ties. So the State Department really hasn't done a good job with the part of the review that they're tasked with. So that's why we were there.
And that was just a draft, we should say, right?
That was a draft.
The final.
Exactly. There was over a million comments were submitted that the State Department is now in the process of reviewing. But, you know, this is the second time now that the State Department has conducted an environmental analysis of Keystone that's been, you know, shockingly insufficient.
Right. They also included the notion that this stuff is going to get out of the ground anyways, right?
I mean, totally just, you know, ignored the sort of the economic facts, what all the analysts, what all the oil industry bankers are saying, which is that we need Keystone XL to ramp up productions.
Right.
And so, you know, that leads to what James Hansen is called the game over for the climate scenario, helping to drain the pool of the tar
now,
sands carbon.
You worked for the Obama campaign in 2008.
That's right, 2008, yeah.
And tell me what you did.
I was on the email team. I was a senior national writer writing emails, and I worked on the fundraising emails that folks may remember.
Right, now, well, this is the thing that people, I mean, this is... you know, this may be a little bit arcane for people, but to be one of the senior writers of the email team meant that at one point the people in the campaign go up to you and go like, "Holy shit!" I mean, they started at one point the guys you're walking around the office with a tremendous amount of respect because what you guys did in that arena was in many respects revolutionary. Also huge for them, but also like really a game changer. And so you were an Obama bot.
That's right, in
some respects. And it must have incredible poignance, I would imagine, for some who are still associated with President Obama from that campaign to see you do this.
Certainly, some people think it's great, and they think it's courageous that I would be out there, having worked for the president, and you know, as they might say, "Oh, aren't you risking alienating, you know, the people you worked with?" And for me, I don't think there should be anything problematic about standing up for the principles that inspired us to work so hard, and not just us as staff members on the campaign, but I mean, millions of people. Who were inspired by the president and worked for him, the people that enabled our fundraising to be historic online,
right,
because they were so inspired, not necessarily by an email that we wrote, but by everything that the president talked about. And so what we're saying is we're the people who got you where you are as staff, as supporters, as donors, as volunteers, and now we really need you to live up to your commitments. We feel like, you know, he really hasn't done it yet. And the Keystone Pipeline is something that is his decision alone. He gets to make the final call on it, and it's literally the simplest thing he can do to send a message that he's ready to lead on climate change.
I want to talk about the pledge and the 63,000 people who have now taken it and what the implications are. But, I mean, when you guys are talking about what is it? Does he think that he's going to pay a legitimate political price by rejecting it? I mean, this is what I find so baffling on some level.
Absolutely.
There does not seem to be a huge constituency out there. There may be, I don't know what the polling says, but it's on the list of importance. For the broad population, it has to be.
He doesn't have to get reelected. Even if he did, it's not like the oil industry would be supporting him. All he has to lose is his supporters, who would be alienated by a decision to approve it.
I mean, so what do you guys, when you guys are sitting in the the offices talking about this, you obviously, you know, have some relationships with people who are still in the administration, and obviously, I mean, what do they say? Why is there this hesitation?
You know, it's fairly unclear. But you know what we've seen with the president is that he really tries to toe this middle ground. He's got this all of the above energy strategy, which is a deeply misguided strategy, treating fossil fuels as if we can continue just producing them as we have been, treating them as if they weren't much more damaging than sustainable sources of energy, which we can totally ramp up and have the power to do that. So it's really difficult to say. But I mean, given his history and I mean, given the fact that he's, you know, sped along to approve the southern leg of this pipeline, the Oklahoma to Gulf Coast leg, which they're building now, and they're seizing people's land in
by
Texas and Oklahoma.
Exactly. This was a common carrier
from a foreign company
that is going to just basically, there's absolutely nothing common about it. This we're never going to see this oil.
Exactly.
It's going to be shipped to wherever it's going, and it's sort of stunning. And one would have thought that we would see, there's some more agitation on the right, but one would have thought we would see even more about the.
There's a fair amount down there. I mean, it's.
Down there, yes.
Yeah, indeed. You would never have thought that you would see, you know, your Tea Party folks and your environmental folks standing together protesting the oil companies. But that, I mean, that's what's happening in Texas and Oklahoma. People are upset,
locally,
and in Nebraska as well.
Locally, but I would have imagined there would be some type of more national sort of response to this, like in the way that we saw with the Kelo case in New London, Connecticut, where there was a taking, an eminent domain taking, and that became a cause celeb for the right. We're not seeing that time and time again. I'm not sure why,
it gets back to the need of the president to lead, and he's the president. He seems to really want to, you know, defer to some public opinion, and we know that climate is a difficult public opinion issue because it's very complex. The risks are different than the risks we're used to being worried about, and so that's why we need the president to step in. He really has tried to toe this middle ground, which is why we built the pledge as a way to really build political pressure on him to just get him to reject this thing.
Okay, now I've spoken to Becky about this pledge, let us know again for those people, because this is pretty astonishing. I don't know. I'm not familiar of something that has ever happened like this before, at least in this manner. 63,000 people have pledged to essentially engage to do what you did Monday. Under what conditions?
Under the condition that if the State Department releases their national interest determination, which is what they're going to do after their environmental assessment, when they finalize that, starts a 90-day process. They confer with other agencies in the Obama administration. They issue a determination of national interest. They're going to make a recommendation in the national interest or not in the national interest. If they recommend it, the president is going to have 2 weeks to finalize that decision, say yes or no. If they recommend that the Keystone Pipeline is in the national interest, that triggers the Pledge of Resistance. So we're going to see actions that have been planned. We're organizing leaders throughout the summer. We're going to be organizing hundreds of folks in their communities to plan an action, to train their fellow local activists to get involved, be ready to participate in safe and peaceful and dignified civil disobedience, and they're going to be ready. And if the State Department issues that draft national interest determination recommending approval of Keystone XL, it's going to be our last-ditch effort to convince the president that you have to reject this. And you're going to see people out there all across the country, literally
63,000 people.
63,000 people have already made the pledge. So what we saw on Monday in Chicago is going to be hundreds, if not 1,000 places all across the country. Folks are going to be getting out and doing the same thing to send the message that the president has got to reject
this. Are you guys going to be having more events, I guess, if you will, or demonstrations, civil disobedience, like you just had in Chicago, sort of say, like, here's a little bit of a down payment.
Exactly.
So you know that,
we know that that the folks who've signed this pledge are serious in their commitment, and we've really seen it when we talk to activists. We really see their commitment, but we do need to demonstrate that in some way. So throughout the summer, we're going to be having about an action each month. We're going to have an action in Texas. We're going to have an action in D.C. Looking at having an action in Boston. So we're gonna have actions one a month.
This is also a way of basically saying to local press, like, this is something you should watch out for. So it puts you on the map, and somebody's on this beat, and so that when this comes out,
and sending a message to the president that if you don't want to see the largest act of civil disobedience in modern American history because of something you did, you got to get your administration to just shut this thing down.
Yeah.
It's that simple.
It's fascinating. So, and we will put a link up on the site at majority.fm to where you can go take the pledge. And what other, now, do you just work, is this, just in terms of, like, Credo's action, like, is this basically your portfolio? Are there other things that are happening, or is this basically at the front of the list right now?
Well, I work on all our environmental campaigns, but this is the biggest environmental campaign we've got going. It's huge. It's Credo, Rainforest Action Network, and the other 98% are all working together to get the pledge going, to do the trainings, to train the leaders throughout the summer, to plan the actions that are happening throughout the summer, and build this thing up so that it's something that really scales to a massive size that we haven't seen in the climate movement, or really in any movement in quite a while.
How long did they hold you in jail in Chicago?
The Chicago police were very lovely, and we were released by 10 a.m. With tickets to appear back in court in July in Chicago.
All right, well, that's good. All right, well, Elijah, I really appreciate your joining us. Like I said, we'll put on the site at majority.fm a link to take the pledge.
NoKXL.org.
Now, when NoKXL.org, when is that that assessment of the national interest, when is that scheduled to?
There's no hard deadline for it, so it's really It could be as soon as they're done reviewing the comments. And for a while, it seemed like in the summer they were going to be releasing it towards the end of the summer. Now it seems like they might be trying to slow the process down. It seems like the longer that we can delay the process, the better chance we have of getting the president to say no, because the arguments for it just keep falling through. Any argument that the pipeline folks make, there's just spill after spill. We keep finding out that the oil is even, or not oil, the crude is worse than we thought. The economics obviously don't make sense for our country, environmental risk, and with each passing, week, it just becomes more apparent.
Interesting stuff. All right, so Elijah, thanks so much for joining
us. Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, we're going to take a, well, I don't know. Oh, we're not going to take a little break because there, right within eyesight, is Tina Dupuy, who is going to sit down at the table. And she is going to, she is the editor
in chief
of the contributor
.com.
So you're Tina, good for you. You're very familiar with what you do.
I can barely hear you, Samuel.
You can barely hear me?
I can barely hear you. Had that microphone in front of your face.
Well, that is the danger of radio, I guess. So Tina, you're at your second or third Netroots, is that right?
Yeah, second or third, something like that.
And you had just had a column this week. Now, I've been on the road, so I sort of missed this comment, sadly. But you had a column this week about about
masturbation, Sam.
Yes. Okay.
Sam. So here's the thing. Republicans have kind of gleefully been talking about rape at any chance they can get.
Right.
It's been this strange trend among Republican lawmakers to talk about rape and how, that really is just a means of conception. For example, like
right.
Paul Ryan talked about, or that the woman's body has a way of shutting that stuff down so we can't actually get pregnant from rape, which would be kind of a surprise to everyone in Mongolia who just so happens to be related to Genghis Khan. Rape happens to be a very fine way of means of conception. Anyway, so there's been this odd trend until this week where you may have heard Republican lawmaker, Texas Congressman Michael Burgess said that that if you, he's of course used to be an OBGYN before he got into the Congress, that if you look at a sonogram of 12-week-old a 12-week-old sonogram, sometimes the males have their hands between their legs.
Right.
So if they can feel pleasure, then they can feel pain. So therefore, we should no longer have legal abortion.
Now, to be fair, he may not know what's involved in masturbation in some way, but it seems to me
we're talking about a Republican lawmaker.
Well, okay.
Their entire platform is masturbatory.
But do we know that really? I mean, you know, I'm sure that my son was doing that quite a bit in the womb. He seems to have stopped now. I mean, he just found his foot, though, after 3.5 months. But my understanding is that they're not necessarily masturbating. Is that...
This is what you would call making things up in order to try to prove your point, which the Republicans tend to do quite often. I covered this for, you know, there was a bill...
Is there any scientific research that says
absolutely.
That they are masturbating, that they... I mean, they're just touching anything. They don't know what they're doing. I mean, my kid, it didn't even seem to he was conscious of where he was for, like, the first 8 to 10 weeks.
No, this is called junk science.
Right.
This is just made-up junk science. I mean, I've covered this, you know, extensively. There was a rumor, and...
You wrote your doctorate on masturbation.
That was my grad school.
Right.
Indeed, there was an Oklahoma lawmaker, a state legislator, who introduced legislation to outlaw fetuses in foodstuffs. Right, exactly. Your eyebrows are raised. You have no idea what I'm talking about. It sounds really weird because it is. Because he was on, I'm not making this up, he was on the internet and found this website that said that abortionists are trying to get us basically to become cannibals. Like, not only are they, you know, in their minds killing babies, but they also want to make us all into cannibals. So it's essentially what would be described as a blood libel.
They're basically putting fetuses into our food.
Right.
Right. Okay.
And so he was going to outlaw this. He was going to make sure that his constituents in Oklahoma would not be subjected to eating fetuses in their foodstuffs.
All right.
So this is what you just call making stuff up. You know, it's stuff that's kind of like, you know, they have a war on science because science, of course, contradicts them all the time because they, you know, just make stuff up, you know, at will. And this is just one of those other things. But really, you know, if you go back to like Jocelyn Elders, who in 1994 in the kind of like apogee of the AIDS epidemic said that maybe masturbation should be taught to like... make, I don't know, the to have, you know, fewer teenage pregnancies and fewer cases of AIDS in this country, the right wing completely flipped out. So this is just, it's kind of like...
You've come full circle.
Really, yeah, no, and it's the right wing really grasping at straws.
They really are, in many respects, just like a circle of jerks.
Yeah, pretty much. It's really, you know... This has been. I'm really proud that was the first one.
The first pun
that was.
That I
yeah,
made.
No. I think that we've really had a very mature conversation about jerking off for the past 7 minutes, and I'm very shocked that's the first one that's come up.
Yes, I know.
The first time it's come up, folks.
So, what? I don't know. It's just sort of stunning to me. I mean that this is the path they're following, but it really is just one more indication. I mean, you know, this of just how sort of out there these guys have become in many respects.
Well, to me, it speaks of desperation. I mean, there's two things that happen with this abortion bill that they try to pass this week. One, it's another symbolic bill that is basically wasting time in Congress, wasting taxpayer money to basically not do their jobs. They're intentionally doing things that make them, it's essentially busy work, make themselves look like they're doing something, but it'll never get to the Senate. It will never, and even if it gets to pass the Senate, it's never going to become law because Obama's not going to sign it.
It's also unconstitutional.
Right, exactly. Well, they don't, I mean, you know, Rand Paul quite famously said that just because the Supreme Court says something is constitutional doesn't make it so. No, that's actually how you say things are constitutional.
Right.
But they don't care about the Constitution unless it's the Second Amendment. Then, you know, that's the absolute. Everything else is kind of subjected to their, you know, their own personal
I mean, I personally feel
opinion.
That, like, you know, the Constitution is obviously a fungible document because because it is a living document.
It absolutely
document.
Has to be.
Right. And
because our mores change all
but
the time.
At this point, they know that it's not there. But, my sense is that what they're doing is not... is in furtherance of an agenda. It happens to be an agenda, I think, that is going to backfire for them. But
I think it's not growing their base. I mean, as the more they cater to their base, the more they isolate women, the more they isolate Latinos, the more they isolate the people who they ultimately are saying, at least, not behind or saying out in public, that they want to bring on to the Republican platform. But what they're doing is just kind of doubling down on this tired... we're going to vote against Obamacare 32 times.
Right.
We're going to do all these symbolic bills. The only thing that the 112th Congress, the last Congress that it was in there, the only thing they were able to accomplish, and they had really a third fewer bills than we'd ever seen in any Congress that's ever existed since we've been counting. The only thing they were able to accomplish in their 2-year tenure was to name things after Reagan. You know, they can't do anything because they spend all their time debating and grandstanding bills that will never become laws. It's a horrible abuse of Congress. There's a reason why their approval rating is tanking. Every time they do a poll, it gets lower and lower, and we come up with new, more witty things to compare it to. I think there are, it's like what Castro is still as popular as Congress, right? I'm just wondering if Castro has gone up in esteem since the last time we took this poll.
I'm not sure that Castro has gone up in esteem relative. They've just gone down.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Well, Tina, I appreciate you coming on and talking to me about this because I feel like I've learned something.
I'm pretty sure that you were very knowledgeable
of
most of the things that we talked about, Sam.
Yeah. The fetal masturbation thing was, I thought I was onto something. Maybe
no,
get bored and forget how to do it.
Another day, another made-up thing from Republicanville.
Yeah, it's just sort of fascinating. Anybody who's had a newborn infant, the idea that they are masturbating is really just bizarre. And the idea that this guy is an OBGYN.
But I think that the taxpayers giving him a job in Congress have saved women from being his patients. I think that at the end of the day, it's like Ron Paul, thankfully, no longer is an OBGYN. There's a lot of people who I think that we should have them in the halls of Congress instead of a hospital.
Indeed. Well, Tina Dupuy, your piece, where can people see your piece?
It's on thecontributor.com.
On thecontributor.com, folks. Visit it today. They often feature some of our videos, too, I understand. Is that right?
Yes, we do. We have Majority Report videos on there all the time. They're very popular. And if you're listening to this right now, you should really subscribe so you can continue to have wonderful and high quality content like we just produced right now.
There you go. All right, Tina, thanks for joining
Hi, Sammy.
Us. All right, folks. That seems to be I want to take just a little bit of a mention. I mean, I was on the Young Turks the other night, and I guess it was two nights ago, Tuesday night, on the day that Michael Hastings died. And we had Michael Hastings on this program a couple of times, at least, I think. And I had come across him in various green rooms and had been on with him, I think, in a couple occasions on Current and maybe MSNBC. It was a real just shocking loss. We touched on it a little bit with Digby and David Dayen, but it was a real shocking and sad turn of events. The guy was obviously an incredibly fearless and independent, though he didn't work necessarily for independent outfits, just independent-minded journalist. And it is a real loss in terms of our ability as a society to know what is up with our military-industrial complex. I know that he was working on a piece on John Brennan from the CIA, and He'd obviously done the sort of very significant pieces on General McChrystal, and he had been writing a lot of pieces about our national security state, and was doing so in a way that few others ever dare to do, in a way in which he alienated much of the journalistic establishment, at least on a professional level. I mean, yes, there's been a lot of stuff written about how he was a nice guy and how he he was very generous, far less accolades while he was alive from, I don't know if the exact same people, but certainly he, people in the establishment media were pissed off because he was telling secrets out of school, which theoretically is what we rely on the media to do. So I just wanted to mention that, you know, like I said, I was on the Young Turks Tuesday night for an hour with Cenk, and much of what we were doing was talking about Michael's passing. Very sad stuff, and I just wanted to make note of that. Today, I guess, will be a Freebie Thursday. Getting all of the Netroots coverage. I'm going to be doing more interviews throughout today that you'll be hearing in the coming days and weeks. We will be live again tomorrow at, I'm 90% sure we're going to start the show at our normal time. It occurred to me at one point, maybe we could start the show a little bit later, because it's 9 a.m. out here when I start the show, and that's early. But it is what it is. Tomorrow we'll have more IMs up. But let me just read this one. We have one IM that is on right now. I just got a fairly inappropriate IM from Michael. Dr. Radman Thies, great shows. Digby and Dayan feels like the progressive superheroes coming together at the Hall of Justice, like Voltron uniting like Netroots gang of three. Thanks. On a sadder note, I didn't catch the beginning of the show. Did you mention the news about Michael Hastings? Yes, I just did, actually. So, yes, he wrote that a while back. All right. All right, folks. That is our program for today. If you have the ability to become a member of the Majority Report, please do. Tomorrow. Oh, wait. You know what? Should we just do it? Well, we got to go, but tomorrow on the program, maybe I'll have Gaius Publius from America Blog on the program. Josh Orton, maybe Atreos might be joining us. I'm hoping to have Ryan Grimm tomorrow. I'm sorry, who? Oh, we're going to have Congressman Bruce Braley on tomorrow. We'll have others on the program tomorrow. We will have many interviews throughout the like I say, the next 2 days, 3 days, and we'll be bringing those to you in the coming weeks. So thanks for joining us. If you can become a member, please do join at majority.fm. You can support the show by buying your Amazon crap through our Amazon link. You can also go to justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. And that is it, folks. I guess we're not going to have a La Poupée today because there was no break. But I will see you tomorrow live. We'll be back tomorrow.